Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
We are joined now by Anne-Marie Allen, who has written a memoir called Serve, which details her life and experiences within Opus Dei from the age of 15 and details the story of how she came to leave that Catholic organisation. Anne-Marie, you are very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Devon.
Listen, before we get to Opus Dei, let's go back to the very beginning. What were you like as a young teenager growing up in Ballyvourney?
I was... I liked dancing. I liked set dancing, actually, the Slea of Lucre set. I liked pop music. I had a job in a local hotel and I loved working there. And I was mad into sport, even though I wasn't involved in sport, but, you know, there was sport all around me. My father, you know, was all the time watching boxing matches and football and soccer and all that. And, you know, my wider family were involved in sport. So sport was all around me, yeah. So, yeah.
Was religion around you? Because, you know, you know, when you look back to those times, I suppose we all had a religious upbringing. But, you know, and I think, you know, it probably would have been very common for people to have nuns or priests in the wider family circle. Was it a particularly religious upbringing for you, do you think?
Well, it was. I was born in the United Kingdom and I came home from the UK when I was 8. And, you know, we were very much a part of the Irish Catholic community in the UK. And, of course, when we came home from the UK, it was a different type of Catholicism. It was much more community-based. But it was very much part of our lives. Yes, I had members of my family that were in religious orders and that. So, yeah, it was a very, very strong part of our community and of our family life, yeah.
When you were younger, you wanted to be a chef. You wanted to go into that world. And an opportunity came up for you to do so, to go to cookery school, and you jumped at that chance. Can you maybe explain to me how that came about, this opportunity to, as you thought, to get a diploma in cooking?
Yeah, well, what happened was that there was an ad in the local newspaper and a friend of mine, her mother saw the advertisement and... she answered it, and between the comings and the goings, these two people came down on a Sunday afternoon of the All-Ireland of 1979.
It's burnt into your memory.
Burnt into my brain, yeah. Kevin Moran was playing for Dublin, I think. But I just remember they brought the two ladies to my family home and said, look, there's this great course that's going and we know you'd like to be a chef. And so they came into the house and it kind of started from there, really.
So these two ladies that came to your family home, and I suppose we have to cast our mind back, like a lot of women, my own mother included, would have left school at 14. Yeah. It wasn't unusual for, I suppose, young people at that time, men and women, to go and do an apprenticeship or in a course. So what were these two ladies offering you?
Well, I think my intention was to stay and do my Leaving Cert and go off and be a chef. And I think that's what the wider family and the immediate family would have wanted. But remember, there was high unemployment and there was huge immigration at the time as well. And so they came in and they were very, very well dressed, very well presented, you know, impeccable in their manners and so on. I mean, I'd never seen anything like this in my life. And they were very interested in me. And of course, I'd never experienced smiling at me and talking to me. And I remember being very, very taken by this. So they were offering us a 2-year course and to get a diploma in institutional catering in their school in Galway. You know, they said, you know, that we would be guaranteed a job afterwards. And of course, that was
a big deal at the time.
That was the sweetener. That was the sweetener that my parents, of course, my parents were worried that we wouldn't get jobs and that we'd have to leave.
And were your parents taken in by these ladies as well, what they had to offer you and, I suppose, by extension to the wider family?
Yeah, 100%. I think my father was a little bit more cynical at the time. My mother was very much, was very taken by them, you know. And as well, we were going to get a pocket money of £5 a week. And we were going to be safe. You know, they wouldn't allow us to watch TV. You know, there would be approved films. So there was this protection and this safety that was marketed to my parents, you know, at that time.
Did it appeal to you, that sense of maybe getting your independence earlier than than others she might have been staying in the school system? Was there?
You know, I read widely. I had read all of Eden Blyton's Mallory Towers. I'm going to boarding school, and you know, I was an only daughter, and my female cousins were mostly younger than me. So you know, so I was really taken by the fact that I might be going to boarding school and hanging out with loads of girls, and you know, doing the midnight feasts and stuff. You know, that's, you know, so I was delighted with it. You know, so
where did you go?
So I ended up, not very long after that interview, there was an interview afterwards that my parents went there, and I think that's in the book as well. You know, they were charmed, and you know, the beautiful building and so on. But I ended up going to Ballyglunin Park in Tuam in County Galway, which at the time was the centre of Opus Dei. And there was it was October 1978, and it wasn't maybe a day or so after Pope John Paul II had been elected.
So it was a heady time.
It was a heady time, yeah.
When did you realise that maybe this wasn't the training course that had been advertised? What were you doing, the girls that were there?
I think we realised fairly quickly. I think there was about eight to ten of us girls all started at the same time. And I remember, you know, there was no curriculum. There was no plan of learning goals or learning outcomes, or no lesson plans or no timetables. You know, we were told this is what's happening. So what we did was the catering school was at the back of the big house, the conference centre. We helped do the catering side of that, the domestic, the cleaning, the laundry and so on. But also there was a male student residence called Gertard in Rockbarton Road in Salt Hill. And we were bussed in, three of us were bussed in there every day to run that residence. There was about 25 to 35 men living there.
So you were in service rather than
in
training.
In training.
Because obviously perhaps your parents broadly knew that it wasn't university, it was a private school. How soon were the ethos and ideas of Opus Dei introduced to you, you know?
The very first night, and I think that's in the book as well. You know, I remember sitting down in the sitting room, and there's this get-together in every Opus Dei centre every night at about 9 o'clock. It's very much a planned kind of a thing where you speak about Opus Dei and the founder and tell anecdotes about the founder. But that night they brought down, I remember a magazine called The Noticias, which is an internal magazine for the women's section, and they showed us pictures of the founder. He had died on the 26th of June 1975, and you know, they were showing that they were members of Opus Dei. He had founded this organisation, and they started telling us about the lives that they lived, and that you know, they were being holy in the middle of the world, and he was going to be made a saint soon, and all this. So I just remember the introduction to Opus Dei started immediately. Like, my parents went out the gate.
Did the attention that had been, as you say, perhaps maybe lavished on you in that early part of the recruitment to the college, did that continue when you were in those early, that early part of your formation?
It did. We were all appointed tutors, and they were to help us with our studies. Okay, but what it in fact was they would have really made you feel special, tell you how lovely you were, and what strengths you had, and so on. And you know, they take you on little walks and little chats and all that. And event
you feel special?
I had never felt like this before in my life. I'd never been, anyone had that much interest in me, and And I think everyone else was the same. God, you know, they were so nice and all the rest of it. You know, what they were doing was getting to know us individually and getting to know what was happening in our lives. And so, you know, I shared my teenage stuff and any issues I had, you know.
Your full confidence?
I did. And I remember them saying, you need to pray to your guardian angel. So that kind of started that. And then, you know, maybe you come to do a bit of prayer with us, or pray to the founder. And it was all very gradual, you know.
When you look back at it, it was quite gradual. When did things, and I keep having to remind myself that you're so young, you're 15 at this time. When did things, or did the atmosphere or tenor begin to change for you?
Yeah, so I just want to go back to an earlier question that Dervil, that you asked. And when did we realise that it wasn't what it was? Not very long afterwards, not very long after we started, really, you know, some of the other girls were saying, sure, this isn't a course at all. We're only here being used to work, you know. And they did kind of do kind of classes, how to make a bed and how to, but, you know, and they brought in some teachers that were there, but they left as soon as they were there, maybe for 5 or 6 weeks, and they would, for an hour a week or something, and they would leave. So, you know, so they start, the girls started to get vocal about it, and they started to leave themselves. So our class got smaller and smaller.
So there's a smaller, smaller group.
Yeah.
You mentioned obviously the introduction of the work of the prayer. They told you that you had a vocation. And again, did that make you feel special, the thought that you had a specific vocation?
Yeah, I'm in the book I talk about a particular thing where there were where items were going missing, and I was called in, you know, and I was said, you know, we think it might be you, and that, and I was absolutely, I mean, I couldn't believe that this was being said to me. I'd never been in trouble before. I didn't know how to handle it. So how I dealt with that was I didn't ring my dad. And, you know, I know now if I'd rang my dad, it would have changed everything. But that was the one thing that really changed everything for me, because what I then did was I noticed they were very cool with me and not being not particularly nice, and they were being abrupt. So I changed. I started to say, oh, what's Opus Dei? And, you know, and next thing, they had me.
So when you started to show that interest, did you have any sense, looking back now, that you actually did have a vocation?
No, I never had a vocation to Opus Dei. They told me I had a vocation to Opus Dei, but I believed them because they were happy, they were holy, they seemed to leave good lives. And I thought that there was something wrong with me. I did believe them, yeah. I never asked to be an assistant numerary.
When you look back, and I know there's different levels of, I suppose, assistant numeraries, some women in Opus Dei get married, they go on to have families. Yeah. When you do look back now, do you think kind of, why me, or what was it they saw in you?
Yeah, I've asked that question every single day of my life. I think that they saw somebody that wanted to be a better person. I wanted a better life for myself. And they saw that. I was vulnerable. I was very innocent and I was very naive and I was ripe for the picking.
So much so that you actually signed up officially. You went to Rome in order to become a member of Opus Dei. Can I just ask you, because you mentioned your dad, did you have much contact with your parents at that time? Had they any sense of what was happening?
You know, when I look back now, many years later, decades later, I look that, you know, there was a lot of attention before I went there and when I arrived there. And then the contact was very minimal, really, you know. Make your phone call from Galway down to Bellavoni at the time was actually a big job, you know, because we didn't have a phone at home and I didn't have the money. And so it was mostly...
You weren't getting paid.
We were getting the £5 a week.
Pocket money.
Pocket money, yeah. And that was just for, you know, the basics, you know. So, and I used to send some of that money home, you know, as well, you know. So I think maybe a year into it, I think my mother said afterwards that she noticed there was a change in the tone of my letters. And she knew something had changed. So, yeah.
As you advanced with your work with the organisation, you were introduced to some more, I suppose, of the norms and the traditions. What were the norms that you experienced?
The norms were going to mass every day, a Latin mass, to do 2 half-hour periods of prayer, spiritual reading for 15 minutes, the 15 decades of the rosary. When you got up in the morning, you got up immediately when you were called. You didn't have an alarm clock. You were called and you had to get up in the morning and kiss the floor and say, serve I am, I serve. Hence the name of my book, because serve is, I suppose, is the word that describes my state during my time as an assistant numerary. So the norms were with that. There was, you know, benediction on a Saturday. There was weekly confession. There was a thing called the weekly chat that you had with one of the directresses. You know, we had to reveal all of our inner thoughts and our feelings and our doubts to that numerary. I now know that at that time there were no... What you said in those confidential chats were compiled and they were called the notes of conscience.
And, a summary. And I think they of course, say now, I think they have said that they don't have records from that period going back. Can I ask you just about another thing that was introduced, and that was the concept of suffering and suffering being something that is glorified or sanctified. How did that play out?
So mortification to me prior to Opus Dei
was being really embarrassed about something.
Well, yeah. but it was, you know, no fish on Good Friday, or no meat on Good Friday, and no sugar in your tea during Lent. You know, that was, you know, and that was very hard, you know. But I was in Opus Dei maybe 2-3 months maybe. And I was, this stage I was 16. And she called me in and she gave me this little bag, and she took out a chain and a whip. And they were the psyllus and the discipline. I had never seen anything like this before. And she very coldly showed me that you put the chain on your leg, on your bare skin, and you were to wear it for 2 hours a day. And I was to tell her when I had it done. And then on a Saturday, then you were to use the whip on your back or bottom or whatever, back of the legs or whatever, to the Hail Holy Queen in Latin. And I was to tell her when I, and if I, you know, and I, and it was just, and I remember just being absolutely shocked. I'd never, ever seen anything like that before. The, you know, there was no kind of period of, do you want to do this? There was no kind of introduction to it. The founder of Opus Dei used to mortify himself, you know, quite a lot. But he said, because you all work so hard, you only have to do it for 2 hours a day.
What was it like the first time you mortified yourself?
Well, I can still feel it on my leg, you know. I could, you'll never forget the feeling of it, you know. I mean, the fact it's so enormous that I did it, and I did it obediently. And sometimes I was told to wear it for longer. If I had, you know, if I shared something, if I had doubts about my vocation, if I said, look, you know, I'm doubting my vocation, which really was, I'm sick of this, you know, I want out of here. They call that your doubts about your vocation. So wear it for an extra hour a day or whatever. We also used to sleep on the floor one night a week without a mattress. Sleep on, then another night sleep without a pillow, and they were norms as well, you know, and mortification. It was all about, suppressing your emotions and your feelings and all that, especially your sexual urges. You know, it was very much focused on that. You know.
And what were fraternal corrections?
Okay. Fraternal corrections were a practice that they used to control our behaviour, and to make, they would tell us to make it more aligned to that of being a good member of Opus Dei. But they came, you know, you'd get them for, there was a whole very strict regime and routine around them. You could get a fraternal correction from an assistant numerary, but that had to be pre-approved by the directress. You had to report back when you had given one. But you could get a fraternal correction from a numerary as well on the spot if you did something. So you never knew when they were coming. So it could be something as minor that you didn't pass the bottle or the jug of water across the table to you, you use bad language, or you were very rude, or and you're not behaving like a saint, you know. So in my book, I talk about a hurling match where Cork were playing, and I got a very severe fraternal correction. I was shouting at the television, get the ball into the goal, so on, and I was called afterwards, and I was told that I hadn't behaved like a saint, that I had behaved like an animal, and that I wasn't to do that again. Yeah. And you had to say, you never could say back, that's ridiculous, for God's sake, that you couldn't say that. You'd have to say, thank you. So, but these fraternal corrections could come at any time. Another time I was working for a full day with a particular person. We had a nice day, we were working hard, and at the very end of the day, she gave me a fraternal correction on something that had happened 2 days beforehand. And so that trust, that bond, you could never build that with any of them.
Obviously, Opus Dei, and including for this programme, reject the characterisations of the mortifications and, you know, their norms and procedures. But When did you begin to question the structure and practices of Opus Dei for yourself? Because you're still, are you still under the age of 18 at this point?
I think I was. I was thereabouts. But I, you know, I suppose just before that, I was very obedient. I did firmly believe that I was I had a vocation because they told me, and so on. But I was very angry with God that he had given me this vocation because I didn't want it, you know, I did not want it at all. But I remember my parents had asked me, well, I had basically told Opus Dei she needs to come home for a week. So I went home and it was
so they were kind of working behind the scenes. They were forming an opinion of their own at that point.
Yeah, Mum and Dad were working behind the scenes. I think at that stage, Picard and Basil Hume had issued some rules in England, in the UK, that my father became aware of. And they said, so there was a whole discussion nationally and internationally about Opus Dei and their access to children and so on at the time. So I went home to my family for a week, and I remember the Stardust tragedy happened, and I remember I came back and I was very sad about it and what had happened, and I remember at that point realizing this isn't good enough. I could see the cracks were beginning to appear.
How did you get home then? Was it with the intervention of your parents?
There was a kind of a long battle really between my parents and Opus Dei, and I remember a couple of bishops got involved and all of that. And then one day my dad said, you have to come home. I was going to be turning 21. I think my parents were afraid that I was going to be shipped off somewhere. I remember they asked my father to write a letter to say that he wouldn't keep me at home. So I remember telling him this is what they want, and he said okay. So he wrote a letter and he said he would not try to keep me. So that letter came, and only when that letter came I was brought down home.
Were the people of, despite your absence, the people of Ballyvourney welcomed you with
absolutely
open arms?
And I didn't particularly know I knew a lot of them, but I didn't know them particularly well because I had only moved to Ballyvourney when I was 12, and I was 15 when I left, and I came back, and I was welcomed with open arms, really. You know, people were very, very kind and very, very generous and very, very respectful, you know. And
was it difficult, Amory, to adjust, because in a sense you're, I think you say in the book, you're sort of caught between two worlds. You'd been in one particular world, you're coming back home, but you hadn't the same, I suppose, late adolescent experience that most of your friends and peers had had.
Yeah, there was a honeymoon period that was great, you know. I was in this world that was far kinder than what Opus Dei had ever told me. You know, people worked much harder than what Opus Dei people said that other people worked, that their standards of work and so on. So there was a real honeymoon period. I remember being able to watch television and read books and buy lovely clothes and go out and all that. So that was fantastic.
Did you feel a sense of loss, though, you know, because people had been mm-hmm. kind to you, they had, as you said, lavish praise on you, all of that. Did you feel any, it might seem like a bizarre question, but did you feel a sense of loss?
I think when I left Opus Dei, when I eventually got to leave Opus Dei, there was that absolute period of they weren't after me, but I couldn't contact my former sister Numeri's friends anymore. That was what was said to me. But I just kind of want to go back there. You know, there was the 6 months honeymoon period, but after that, I started to go downhill. You know, there was the panic attacks, there was the PTSD, there was the long periods of total isolation, you know, social paralysis, you know, and then I kind of get over that. I'd go out again, but it was very much cyclical. That went on for about 20 years, you know. But I think the one thing that sustained me during that period was education.
Not for the first time, it's a way out.
I did not stop reading. I did not stop listening to the radio. I went back to school. I did my Leaving Cert. I did every little course you could find. And
but what's really interesting is that having been, in one sense, in having lived in an institution in the broader sense, you end up working in the prison service.
Yeah. I had a lot of transferable skills. You know, I wore a uniform. Yeah. I followed a set rules and regulations. There was very much a hierarchical structure, and I think I fitted in very, very well for a long. But the difference was, I got paid. Yeah. I got holidays. I could, you know, when I was sick, I could go sick. Mm. You know, if I worked extra time, I got paid. You know, I had somebody, I had people I could go to if I needed to talk things out. And
you did speak to, not for a very long period of time, but you did eventually speak to people. So who or what was it that sort of maybe opened the door or gave you the key to go back and start talking about your experiences?
Well, it was just remarkable, really. I was in the Midlands prison one day, and there was the chaplain there, Sister Breatha Coleman, who has since passed away, may she rest in peace. But she just said to me one day, she just caught me in the corridor and said, "What's your story?" Great question, yeah. Brilliant question. So I said, I just spat it out, and she left, and she came back the next day, and she said to me,
I'm a former member of Opus
Dei. So then she said, "Do you want to speak to ex-members? Would it help?" And I said, "I'm the only one that left." And she said, "No, you're not." So she put me in contact with one person, and I met that person, and it was transformative. I just was blown away. So then after that, then I started to look for other ex-members. And eventually I got in contact with a few assistant numeraries, Irish ex-assistant numeraries. And it was a very tentative at the beginning, because each of us didn't know where the other one stood, or, you know, we were all very afraid.
Yeah. And obviously, in part, we came to know your story because a number of you spoke to the Financial Times, which led out on its own investigation last year. Were you worried about speaking out?
I was terrified, yeah. I was terrified because, you know, I lived in shame all of my life, really, with this, you know. Now, a good few people knew, but there were many that didn't know that part of me. I felt a responsibility that we had to talk about this subject of religious servitude. I think that discussion has to be had, you know. It's not the only institution. I was terrified, but I knew when the Financial Times article came out that we'd done the right thing, 100%.
And one of the things they said is that the criticism from former members, including you, has prompted institutional reflection leading to safeguarding improvements and changes in the way we do things. We have listened and are learning. What would you hope to achieve by this book, which has now gone out into the wider world?
You know, many members left with just a shirt on their backs, no savings, no pension, no social welfare payments, and, you know, socially isolated and no qualifications and so on. And I think Opus Dei needs to make some kind of compensation.
Would you ever wish to go back and have contact, or would that be too painful for you now?
Under no circumstances, no. Be too traumatic, yeah.
It's a remarkable book. This is Your Truth. It is Serve. It is published by Gill, and it is out already. Anne-Marie Allen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Right. Thank you very much, Derval. Much appreciated. Thank you.
Well, we sought a detailed response to Anne-Marie Allen's book, Serve, from Opus Dei, and they said, "We remain greatly saddened to again read Anne-Marie's account of her experience with us over 40 years ago. Given the passage of time and absence of historical records, it's extremely difficult to adequately respond to all of the serious and upsetting allegations Anne-Marie makes. Many of these genuinely do not accord with those of long-standing members who were part of Opus Dei alongside Anne-Marie." The organisation said, "Nonetheless, it's clear that Anne-Marie has been deeply affected, which she attributes to her time with us, and for that we are profoundly sorry. We have repeatedly publicly said that we want to listen and learn from individuals' testimonies, and it's fair to say that as a result, some practices and approaches within Opus Dei have changed over the years as society itself has changed. Nonetheless, to portray Opus Dei as an organisation with malign intent could not be further from the truth," said Opus Dei, adding that if anyone wished to make contact with them, they can get in touch with the organisation directly.
email brendan@rte.ie.